Okay, so I am Rishi Gamani-Marzowski. I'm one of the health economists here at HERC, and I'm going to be giving a part one of a two-part lecture today, which is about evidence synthesis for decision modeling. We've broken this lecture up into two parts because it's just too long to fit into one 1 hour segment. So today we're going to be talking about how we prepare for a meta-analysis, which ends up being a pretty time-consuming endeavor in and of itself. In the next lecture, we'll be talking about how to actually conduct a meta-analysis. You guys have probably seen me present, if you've been following this course, you've seen me present this type of decision model multiple times before, where we have two treatments that we're evaluating in terms of their success of treating patients that are infected with some sort of hypothetical illness. And we want to understand the effect of each one of these treatment options on the likelihood of a patient achieving treatment failure or treatment success. So this is the basic structure of the decision model, and the decision model requires inputs in order to run. The inputs I have that are noted in the blue box here are the transition probabilities or the likelihood of achieving treatment failure or treatment success. Transition probabilities are one type of input that you need for a decision model, but there's a number of different types. This is an example of a cost-effectiveness analysis that was published in Neurology in 2009. And it was looking at different ways to treat aneurysms. And table one here shows all of the different inputs they had for their decision model. And you can see that there's a number of different inputs as they relate to treatment success of the first treatment option, which is surgical clipping, versus the second treatment option, which is endovascular coiling. They look at the probabilities of achieving, the patient dying, becoming disabled, regrowing the aneurysm, the aneurysm reopening, the coil failing, and the aneurysm reopening, and then also some adverse events as well. When you have inputs into a decision model, those inputs have a point estimate noted here, but then they also have an estimate of variation around that point estimate, as you can see here, for the range of the distribution. We've spoken about this slide before. There are two main ways to derive model inputs for use in your decision model. The first would be to transform existing data inputs, and my last lecture talked about how to do that. The second way that you can derive model inputs is to synthesize available data, and you can do that through conducting a meta-analysis, a mixed treatment comparisons analysis, or a meta-regression. In today's lecture, we're really going to spend a lot of our time speaking about meta-analysis. And how to prepare for doing a meta-analysis. In the next lecture, we'll talk about the meta-analysis and we'll touch on the mixed treatment comparisons. Before I go any further, I just want to get a sense of the audience's familiarity with meta-analyses. So if you can just reply back to us and let us know whether you've conducted many meta-analyses, have conducted one, are looking to conduct one, or just looking for general information by attending this lecture.
And we're getting poll responses in. We'll give everyone a few more moments to respond, and then we will go through the results here. And it looks like we're starting to slow down, so I am going to close this out. And what we're seeing is 10% of the audience saying that they have conducted many meta-analyses. 17% have conducted one. 21% are looking to conduct one. And 52% are looking for general information. Thank you, everyone.
Great. Thanks, Heidi. All right. So I hope that this lecture will be of use to the folks that are looking to conduct one or looking for general information. For the people that have already conducted a meta-analysis or have conducted many, this sounds like this is going to be a refresher for you guys. So let's talk first about why we should even conduct a meta-analysis. The reason we do so is because for the question of our interest, we do a literature search and we find that multiple studies have actually evaluated and answered our question. What we want to do is create a single pooled estimate from these studies, and that's exactly what the meta-analysis does. The idea behind this is that the pooled estimate that you create based on these multiple studies is going to be higher quality than an estimate that's provided by any single study. And the reason this is because single studies may just be too small, so they may not be well-powered enough. But also, if you have multiple studies, not only do you increase your power as your sample size increases, but multiple studies also allow you to figure out whether findings are reliable. So there are a number of different studies that exist in the literature, and they all come to different conclusions. then you can evaluate that and understand that there still are some questions left to be answered or some heterogeneity in the responses. When you pool all the studies together and you increase your sample size, you can also reduce the effect of random error and produce more precise measures of effect. If you have multiple studies, you can evaluate variation between studies and potentially evaluate factors that might modify treatment response. So this increase in power and increase in precision and opportunity to settle controversies that come from conflicting studies are benefits of meta-analyses. But if meta-analyses aren't conducted properly, they also have a very strong potential to mislead. And so today we're going to talk about how to actually properly conduct meta-analyses. If you do a PubMed search for your question of interest, you're oftentimes going to find that there are multiple studies that have answered your question. And the thing that you need to contend with is which study to select. So here we have a study where I'm, or a research question where I'm looking at the influence of vitamin C or ascorbic acid on the common cold. And I do a PubMed search and I see that there's 66 clinical trials that have studied this question. And if I am doing a cost effectiveness analysis looking at using vitamin C to treat the common cold, I would need to figure out which one of these studies to select as a model input to my decision analysis. And the question of which study to select is answered by noting that you should select all of the studies that are relevant to your research question. You shouldn't just decide to select one of these RCTs and abandon the others. Rather, what you should do is look and read all of these RCTs and see if you can synthesize them into a single pooled estimate. So for this analysis, what I would do is go and pull all 66 of these RCTs and see if I can amalgamate them through a meta-analysis. Sometimes it can help to see the end goal in order for you to understand and visualize what needs to be done in order to get to that end goal. So this is the end goal of a meta-analysis. This is the type of graph or figure that would be produced. This is an example of a meta-analysis that was published in JAMA in 2012 looking at people who took omega-3 fatty acid vitamin supplements and then their risk of major cardiovascular events. What we see here is a number of different boxes. Each box corresponds to a study. The size of the box is proportional to the inverse variance. Larger studies have a smaller variance, and therefore they have larger boxes here. And we have a dividing line here, a relative risk of 1.0, which means that there's no difference between the treatment and the comparator. And so you can see here that there's a number of studies that are falling on this line of 1.0, or even if studies don't fall on this line of 1.0, their confidence intervals cross this line of 1.0. Here we have a pooled effect that relates to mixed prevention, another pooled effect here denoted by the diamond that relates to secondary prevention, a third pooled effect that relates to ICDs. I think this is needing a defibrillator. Sorry, I don't quite remember. And then we have an overall pooled effect across all of these different outcomes. So this is really what we're going to end up creating with our meta-analysis. And what I'll now spend the rest of the lecture and the next lecture doing is going through step-by-step of how we can actually produce this type of a graph for our own research questions. Oh, I should also mention here, these are the raw data that come from the study themselves. These are the summary statistics. So in this case, each study was evaluating a relative risk of the outcome relative to a control group. And then this graph here is a forest plot. We'll talk a lot about those. And then each study has its own weight in terms of producing this pooled estimate, and the studies that have a smaller variance have a more precise estimate, which is oftentimes the larger studies, are the ones that contribute more data to the overall pooled estimate. And you can see that here, that the size of the box relates to the weight. Okay. So let's talk a little bit about meta-analysis and what is happening behind the scenes of a meta-analysis before we get into more specific details. In the first step of a meta-analysis, you calculate a summary statistic, or I should say you pull out a summary statistic for each study that's already going to be reported in that journal article. So here, for example, we may have some sort of treatment A and treatment B And treatment A is associated with an outcome of 30 units. Treatment B is associated with an outcome of 20 units. The summary statistic is 10 units from this one study because we're looking at comparative data of treatment A versus treatment B. However, you can also have non-comparative data that you pull out of a study. So, for example, we may be just looking at the mortality associated with an intervention, and that's reported in the literature as being 5%. So we would just pull that statistic out of the study, in which case it is non-comparative data. The thing that you need to keep in mind is that if you want to use this input into a decision model, you need to produce non-comparative data from your meta-analysis. The decision model itself is comparing one treatment to another treatment, and therefore that decision model needs as an input the efficacy of one treatment, and it needs as a separate input the efficacy of the separate of the second treatment. The decision model does the comparison for you, so it needs treatment-specific estimates rather than comparative data as its input. And therefore, for your meta-analysis, which is what you're doing in order to create inputs for your decision model, you also need to produce non-comparative estimates from that meta-analysis. After you've pulled out the summary statistic from each study, you need to weight that specific estimate. I should say that there are some situations in which the summary statistic is not weighted, but that is definitely not the norm. There is an organization called the Cochrane Collaboration, and they produce a lot of meta-analyses and produce a lot of guidance about how to produce high-quality data and meta-analyses, and they recommend that you use weights for each one of your studies. The weight can be created in a number of different ways. Generally, what you should be doing is using an inverse variance method that we alluded to before, which is that the studies that have the smaller variance get more weight, they're more precise. Usually this is because they're larger studies, they're more precise. And so this is where, you know, if you have a study that has 1,000 people versus a study that has 50 people, you want the study with 1,000 people to contribute more to the meta-analysis than the study that has 50 people. If you don't do the weighting, then those studies contribute equally to your pooled estimate. Some people have talked about using quality weights to say that a study that has higher quality should be given higher weight in the meta-analysis than a study that has poorer quality. That is recommended against by the Cochrane Collaboration. The reason is because it's not really possible to know the true risk of bias in a study. And so what they recommend is that if you think a study is really biased, that you should exclude that study entirely, rather than using a numerical value to assign study quality to that study and including it in the meta-analysis. The Cochrane Collaboration spends a decent amount of time talking about quality weights in their handbook, and essentially they go through and denote that it's really hard to know how to construct an appropriate quality score. You have to decide to combine factors associated with whether blinding was conducted properly, whether randomization was done properly, whether patients were followed up in the right way. And right now, there's not really an agreed-upon way to do that. And so the use of quality weights is recommended against by Cochrane, and most high-quality meta-analyses just use this inverse variance method of weighting each study. Once you've pulled out the summary statistic from each study and weighted it according to its inverse variance, then the individual weighted estimates are averaged in order to create your pooled point estimate. And that's what this meta-analysis is. It's the computation of this weighted mean estimate. And this could be a weighted mean estimate of a number of different types of summary statistics. You could do a meta-analysis of means, of probabilities, odds ratios, relative risks. Really, you know, if there's a summary statistic reported, and most studies are using a summary statistic, you can combine them into a single pooled estimate. It doesn't just have to be probabilities or odds ratios, for example. So now that you've got your point estimate, your pooled point estimate, what you need to do is calculate the variance around that pooled point estimate, because of course there's uncertainty in every single study that comprises your meta-analysis, and therefore your pooled point estimate is also going to have uncertainty around it. And so really what meta-analysis is in its entirety is the computation of a mean estimate that's weighted, along with an estimate of variation around this mean. And again, it could be a mean of means, a mean of probabilities, a mean of relative risk, a mean of odds ratios, a number of different summary statistics. So we just talked about sort of the 30,000-foot perspective of how a meta-analysis is conducted. And I also want to briefly spend time on what a meta-analysis does not do in hopes that this will provide appropriate levels of clarity for you all. The meta-analysis does not combine the 2x2 tables from each study in order to construct an overall 2x2 table and then calculate a summary statistic from that. So here we have 2x2 tables. Maybe the one on the left is from study number one, and the one on the right is from study number two. This is not what happens. So what you do is you do not sum the cells of the 2x2 table to create an overall 2x2 table and then calculate a summary statistic of this overall 2x2 table. That is not what is happening in a meta-analysis. The data from the studies are kept separate in the meta-analysis, and then they are pooled. The data from the studies in terms of the summary statistics are kept separate, and the summary statistics are pooled. The individual underlying data are not necessarily pooled. So when we create a pooled estimate, what we're really doing, this is an example, if we have a relative risk of our outcome, and we have three studies, A, B, and C, is that we're pulling the relative risk from study A out of the literature. From study B and study C, we're pulling those relative risks. We transform them into log relative risk. We'll talk about that later. And then what we do is from these summary statistics, we calculate an overall summary statistic from these three studies. Which in this case would be the summary log relative risk or log risk ratio, which we then transform back into the natural scale in order to get a summary relative risk or risk ratio. If we had a mean as our outcome as opposed to a relative risk, then what we would do is the same thing. We would pull the mean from study A, the mean from study B, the mean from study C, and then we would amalgamate them in order to create a pooled mean across these three studies. All right, so now I want to just give you some more specifics about how to actually conduct the meta-analysis. So there's 7 different steps that you need to take. First, you do a systematic literature review, and the important thing to know is to make sure nobody else has already published a meta-analysis. So you should go to PubMed, you can go to the Cochrane Collaboration, go online to all of your normal sources of scientific evidence in order to make sure nobody has done the same meta-analysis that you're hoping to do, because otherwise you're doing a lot of work for not much novelty. Once you've done your systematic literature search, you do a title and abstract review, you extract data from the studies you decide to keep, you separate out observational studies and randomized controlled trials, convert all of your outcomes to the same scale, evaluate the heterogeneity of your responses across studies, and only then, once all that is done, do you conduct the meta-analysis. So we'll go into all of these things in detail. But one thing that I want to make clear right now is that not only are there a lot of steps that need to be done before you are actually able to conduct a meta-analysis, but a lot of these steps are more qualitative in nature. So really it's only the last three steps that are quantitative. The ones before that are not really quantitative. When you conduct a systematic literature search, there's a number of good practice guidelines, and that's what makes it really systematic rather than being just a literature search. It's really important to determine your inclusion and exclusion criteria a priori. Before you start reading the studies, you really need to figure out what your inclusion and exclusion criteria for those studies are. So you want to do things like think about the years of analysis. If something changed in practice over time, you'll want to be careful about the years of the publications that you include in your systematic literature research. So, for example, if you were doing something on hepatitis C, the hepatitis C treatment landscape has changed dramatically, and the dual drug combinations of using interferon and ribavirin that was really the standard of practice in the 2000s are no longer used because there's so many more effective medications. And so you know, you probably want to exclude those years of analysis from your systematic literature review and from your meta-analysis because they relate to drugs that are no longer being used. You may also want to think about what countries you're looking at. So, you know, if your intervention is something like a diabetes management program, and that could have very culturally specific components, you may want to limit your systematic literature search to studies conducted in the United States only. Whatever inclusion-exclusion criteria you have, the important thing is that you and your co-investigators agree upon them a priori and that you document them a priori as well. Once you have your inclusion-exclusion criteria specified, you do your database search. And so the important thing to remember here is that you need to save the search strings that you use. So if you're doing this search in PubMed, you might be able to use your MeSH headings. And if not, you know, you have your own combination of search terms that you're using. And you probably have a variety of combinations of search terms that you're using in order to really capture the entirety of the literature. It's really, really important to save those search strings because generally in a journal article for a meta-analysis, you will need to publish those and tell people how you search for your literature. In this step, you really want to cast as wide a net as possible, and you could always exclude studies. But you don't want to be getting three or four steps down the line in your systematic literature search and realize that you are not, you don't have the right search strings or the right inclusion criteria to capture relevant articles. If that's the case, you're going to have to go back to square one. So really be generous in this step as much as possible. Other ways to make sure that you are actually doing a systematic literature search and not just doing a literature search is being really rigorous about your follow-up of articles. You should, of the articles that you end up keeping, you should search the reference sections and make sure that you've collected all relevant articles that are included in those reference sections. Sometimes there are randomized controlled trials that are not published in the in journals, maybe because the findings were inconclusive, but oftentimes because the findings were negative. Or there was no significant difference between two different groups. In that case, you should definitely be searching, in all cases, you should search clinicaltrials.gov. This is a website that was launched in September of 2008. It doesn't have data on all clinical trials because not all trials are legally required to be registered, but it does have data on a lot of clinical trials because the FDA requires that all Phase 2 and Phase 3 trials for drugs or biologics or devices have to be registered here. And on this website, these studies have to report the results of their RCTs. So even if there's not a journal article published about this RCT, the data relevant to the RCT will be found on this website. You should definitely search that as well. There's also something called the gray literature, and that's stuff that's not peer-reviewed. So that might be something like abstracts from conferences. You and your co-authors and co-investigators will have to decide whether you do want to include these or exclude these. If you want to include these, then you'll have to kind of go to the conferences that you think are relevant to your research question and search for their abstracts. This is a time-consuming process. It is generally very, very labor-intensive. It's important that you allocate enough time and resources to do this and to do this well because this is the foundation of your entire meta-analysis. So once you've spent oodles of time doing your systematic literature review and searching the gray literature, looking at reference sections from articles, trying different search strings to produce abstracts, that's when you need to, the next step is when you actually do a title in your abstract review. So you want to read through all of the titles of the studies. You discard those that immediately are identified as irrelevant. Of the remaining studies, you read through their abstracts, and then you discard those that are irrelevant. You don't want to spend too much time on the abstract and the title review. A good rule of thumb is about 60 seconds per abstract. I usually focus in first on the methods section. The intro and the conclusions are not usually so relevant, but the methods and sometimes the results can be elucidating in terms of what they did. So once you've read through all of your abstracts, spend about 60 seconds on each, discarded those that are irrelevant, then you go to the full text review of your remaining studies. When you discard the remaining studies that are irrelevant after you did your full text review, you need to keep track of why you discarded those studies. You don't need to keep track of why you discarded the titles or the abstracts, but you do need to keep track of why you discarded the full text reviewed studies. And that's because you're going to have to create a PRISMA diagram when you submit your meta-analysis for publication in a journal. So this is an example of a PRISMA diagram. You can find the PRISMA diagram at this, using this citation below. There's a group of people that have created best practices for reporting systematic literature reviews and meta-analyses. And you can read their article for more information. But essentially what you want to do is when you do your PRISMA diagram, you identify the records that you found through your database search, so like your PubMed search, then the number of records you identified through other sources like clinicaltrials.gov or the gray literature or reference sections from articles. Then, of course, you want to remove duplicates, and then you save the number of records that you have. And then you have the number of records that you screen, so your titles, your abstracts, and the number that you excluded from title and abstract review. Then you have the number of full text articles that you reviewed, and you can see here that you have to both keep track of the number of full text articles you excluded, but also the reasons for why you excluded that. So that's where you need to start doing some detailed record keeping. And then from there, you report the number of studies that you finally included in your qualitative synthesis, and then those that you included in your quantitative synthesis, which is the meta-analysis. Okay, so you've done all of your title, abstract, full text review. You've figured out the number of studies and which studies you want to include in your systematic literature review and hopefully meta-analysis. And now what you need to do is extract data from the studies that you're including. I've included a link here to the PRISMA template, and that's these people that produce these good reporting practices guidelines, and so you can see what their template is for pulling data out of selected studies. And you can also create your own template. So what I've included here is the type of information that I generally pull out from when I'm doing data extraction for a meta-analysis. You can in terms of your template, you should definitely create a template and then fill it in. Oftentimes, you have multiple people that are extracting data from studies, and so you want to make sure everybody is doing this in a very uniform fashion. So you want to make sure any categories are pre-specified in your template so that values are recorded in the same way every time, regardless of who is actually recording them. So I do things like look at the author, the year, the journal, the type of study design, and you can see here I have examples of it could be an RCT, an observational study, case control study, et cetera, et cetera. If I was to create a data extraction template, let's say I was doing it in Excel, which is just fine to do, or Red Cat, for example, I would actually create answer choices for RCT, observational study, and case control study so that people would select them when they're doing the data extraction if, let's say, I and three other people were doing the data extraction across the studies. Otherwise, it can be difficult to amalgamate the information. If one person writes out randomized controlled trial and another person writes out RCT, you end up just having a headache trying to identify that those are both the same thing, just written in different ways. I always note what the treatment arm is, and then if it's a medication, what the dosage is of that treatment, because of course you could have two studies looking at the same treatment, the different dosages, and that could affect the likelihood of a response. The sample size in arm one and arm in the next arm. You may want to have multiple categories for this. If there's a lot of attrition of those patients, you may want to record the sample size at baseline, the sample size in the mid-study, the sample size at the end. Any demographic characteristics you think are important. The follow-up time, this is really important because even if two studies are evaluating the same treatment, the same dose, the same types of patients, and measuring the outcome the same way, one may have looked at the outcome at 3 months, and another one may have looked at the outcome at 12 months, and that could cause some heterogeneity in response. The measurement of the outcome, so you notice this is different than the value of the outcome. The measurement of the outcome is what summary statistic they're using to measure the outcome, and then also what summary statistic they're using to measure the variation of the outcome, and then you record the actual value of the outcome and the value of the variation separately. Another thing to keep in mind is you need to evaluate whether this is an intent to treat analysis or a per protocol analysis or whether they've reported both of these things. This can be a little bit more challenging to pull out of journal articles. Sometimes you may actually need to email the study authors to understand what they did if they did not not report this properly. Okay, and then you can also evaluate the risk of bias within a study, and I'll talk more about that in the coming slides. One thing that I do want to mention here is that when you do data extraction, you really need to spend some time trying to find the right balance of how you do the data extraction. Extracting too much data from a study is a waste of time. So don't think you should pull every single type of information out of each single study. That can easily end up eating up hundreds of hours of people's time. On the flip side, extracting too little data is also a waste of time because you're going to have to go back to the articles for additional information, and that's time consuming in and of itself. So generally what I do is I do some tests of my templates. So these are my recommendations to you of good research practices for data extraction. I mentioned before that variables should be reported in the same way. So RCT and randomized control trial are two different ways of reporting the same information. Standardize that. It will save you so many hours of headache and frustration later on down the road. In order to make sure that you're striking the right balance of getting enough information and not getting too much information, test your template with a number of studies. Revise that template as you need. So, you know, maybe take three studies and extract data using your template, figure out what works, what doesn't work, iterate on your template before you finalize it. If you have research assistants that are doing the data extraction, have them each run through a small number of papers that you've already done the data extraction from, and then compare results. Compare their results to each other, compare their results to you, and use that as a learning experience to update your data extraction template accordingly. So it can be tricky to do this data extraction. Rushing will cause you a lot of strife down the road. So really be sober and deliberate about how you do this. You can create a lot of headaches can be created with data extraction. So for example, for sample size, you know, you may have one person that's recording total sample size across the whole study, and another person is recording an arm-based or a treatment-based sample size. So obviously that's a discrepancy that you need to resolve. Or maybe, you know, you've said, I want to pull up the mean and the standard deviation from these studies, and what the article reports is a mean, a median, and an interquartile range. So you have a mean, but you don't have the standard deviation that you wanted. So in this case, you would have to have your data extractors record the median and the interquartile range because there's no estimate of variation around the mean. So these are just some of the examples of the data extraction headaches that can and will happen. There's no way to eliminate your data extraction headaches, but you can certainly mitigate it by being thoughtful at this step. All right, risk of bias. So the Cochrane Collaboration recommends that you qualitatively evaluate the risk of bias rather than having it be a numeric value. They essentially say that it's not a great idea to use a scale or a checklist to derive a single numeric value for the risk of bias of a study. The reason being that current scales and checklists don't contain the right criteria, and it's also hard to deal with studies that have incomplete reporting of the variables involved in assessing bias. And then, like we talked about before, if you calculate a single score of bias, it also means that you have to assign weight to the items that comprise bias. And right now, it's just hard to justify using any weights in particular. What they recommend is that you qualitatively evaluate the risk of bias within a trial as well as across trials. So this is an example from their handbook. I have a reference to this handbook in the end slides. But this is an example from their handbook of how to evaluate qualitatively within trial bias. And they have different types of domains. They have selection bias, performance bias, detection bias, attrition bias, reporting bias, and then this other source of bias. And you can take a look at these yourself in order to familiarize yourself with these different types of biases. They also want you, at the end of your study, to assess bias across all of the studies that you've used in your systematic literature review or meta-analysis. And so they have different ways of doing this, and you can go look at their handbook. They have tables, they have figures. I particularly like this figure. I think it's just a nice summary that makes it very clear to the reader the extent of bias that's occurring. So here they still have their selection bias, performance bias, detection bias, attrition bias, reporting bias. They've made these a little bit more specific as they relate to the outcomes that are denoted in the timeframes that are studied in their systematic literature review. But they have, you know, each study is a row, is a column, and then each type of bias is a row, and then they show you how well a study performed on each one of these types of biases. So this is just kind of a nice visual representation. But again, you can see it's entirely qualitative. There's nothing quantitative happening here, and all of these studies were included in their systematic literature review. Okay, so randomized controlled trials and observational studies, should they be both included in the same meta-analysis? And the answer choices are, this is a question obviously, the answer choices for you are yes, they should both be included in the same meta-analysis, yes, but do subgroup analyses on each separately, or no, they should be considered separately.
And responses are coming in. Again, we'll give everyone a few moments to respond before we close the poll out and go through the responses. And it looks like we are slowing down here, so I'm going to close the poll. And what we are seeing is 8% of the audience saying yes, 54% of the audience saying yes, but you should do subgroup analysis on each separately, and 38% saying no, they should be separated. Thank you, everyone.
Great. So thank you, folks, for your feedback. The correct answer is that no, they should be separated. The observational studies and the randomized control trials should be considered distinct in your meta-analysis. And so the reason is that observational studies have systematic differences between the groups and randomized control trials do not. So if you are extracting a relative effect from each study, you're going to want to keep the observational studies and the randomized control trials entirely separate. So the idea of an observational study and the selection issues are that you're really just looking at what happened in the real world, and presumably there's a reason that patient Jane Doe received treatment A and patient John Smith received patient treatment B. And that may not be observable from your data set, but that means that there's some sort of unobserved systematic difference between the group of people that got treatment A and the group of people that got treatment B. And that's going to cause some sort of selection bias in your results. So if the people that a physician thinks are going to respond better to a drug get that drug, then that's actually going to overestimate the efficacy of that drug as it relates to the population. In a randomized controlled trial, people are randomly assigned to an intervention, and the idea being that if the randomization is conducted appropriately and the sample size is sufficiently large, that all of the other unobserved characteristics or observed characteristics that could affect treatment response are balanced across the two groups, and thus the only difference between the two groups is in their receipt of a treatment. So you'd want to keep those observational studies and randomized control trials separate. However, there may be situations in which you do a meta-analysis just on the observational studies. And that may be because the RCTs that exist may not be generalizable to the population that's in your cost-effectiveness analysis, or there just may not be information from randomized controlled trials. So you don't want to kick out the observational studies from your systematic literature review entirely. You just want to keep them separate from the randomized controlled trials. In some situations in your systematic literature review, you may not have any randomized controlled trials. So if you're doing something that looks at the impact of smoking on some sort of a negative outcome, or impact of smoking on an outcome, it's unethical to randomize people to smoking versus not smoking. No IRB is going to approve that, and so you're not going to have any randomized controlled trials that randomly assign people to smoking. And so you're just going to have to use observational studies, in which case there's no, you know, there's no separating out because there's no RCTs that are in your systematic literature review. However, if you do have a mix of the observational studies and the RCTs, please do keep them separate before you combine them. Combine the results from those studies. Okay, so we've now done our data extraction. We've kept our observational studies separate from our randomized control trial studies. Now what we need to do is convert all outcomes to the same scale. So we have to make sure that the studies that we're pulling data out of are using the same statistics. So for example, if you're looking at binary data, you want to make sure that all the studies are using an odds ratio, or they're all using relative risk. Now this could get a little bit challenging. It may require the involvement of a PhD statistician to change one summary statistic into another summary statistic. You know, sort of proceed with caution, if you will. Binary data are generally what we need for a decision model. And so since we're talking about meta-analyses to produce inputs to a decision model, what you're oftentimes going to see is that you have an odds ratio or a relative risk that's reported in the literature. In these situations, we want to work in the log scale, and we'll talk about this in, I think, the next slide. If you have continuous data, maybe cost data, for example, which is continuous and could be an input to your cost-effectiveness analysis, you want to work in standardized means if the data are not reported on the same scale. Obviously, costs are always reported on the same scale, but maybe you have some other type of continuous data and they have different units in that continuous data. Work with standardized means. Or you could have, let's say, a risk difference that's also reported, in which case you would work in the absolute scale. Okay, so that might be a little bit confusing. So let's explain why I'm asking you to work in the log scale for binary data. The reason is because you want to maintain symmetry in your analysis. So here's an example. We have two groups, group A and group B. In the first study, the risk of the event is twice in group A what it is for group B. The second study, we find something really different. We see that the risk of an event and the risk of an outcome is one half for group A what it is for group B. If these studies have equal weights, then they should negate each other, right? But if you are using relative risk as your outcome, which is oftentimes what's going to be reported in the study, then study 1 would have a relative risk of 2.0 and study 2 would have a relative risk of 0.5. And when you average these two, that yields a mean relative risk of 1.25. What you would want to see is a mean relative risk of 1.0 because these two things with equal weight should cancel each other out. In the log scale, however, these two estimates do cancel each other out. The two estimates are 0.693 and negative 0.693. So that's why we're working in the log scale rather than in the natural scale when we're dealing with the relative risk and odds ratio. Okay, you've now converted all of your summary statistics to be the same type of summary statistic. And then what you can do is evaluate the heterogeneity of the studies that you have. Now this step is really, really important. And the reason is because if you don't have enough data, you don't have enough studies, the studies are of low quality, or the studies are too heterogeneous, this is the end. You can't do the meta-analysis. You have to stop with the systematic literature review. And so this step gives you sort of the go-ahead to proceed with meta-analysis or not. And there's two ways that you can evaluate the heterogeneity of your selected studies. One is informal. You just review your data extraction template, the one that's been filled out, and peruse it to understand whether there's a lot of heterogeneity, a lot of in terms of outcome, heterogeneity in terms of the population being studied, the treatment doses being evaluated, the follow-up times, et cetera, et cetera. The other mechanism to evaluate heterogeneity is formal, and there are statistical tests and also graphical assessments. So let's talk about this informal assessment of heterogeneity. What you want to evaluate from your data, your completed data extraction template, is whether there are differences in the study population. If you are evaluating the impact of a treatment on cardiovascular events, you want to make sure that patients have similar BMI at baseline or similar history of having myocardial infarction at baseline. You want to evaluate differences in length of follow-up. This is really going to happen quite frequently, and it is important. A trial with a short versus a long follow-up time could yield very different responses. And so you definitely want to keep good track of that. There might be differences in the way the outcomes are measured. So this might be both things like, the instrument used to measure an outcome is different. So for example, if you were looking at utilities, which are an input into a cost-effectiveness analysis, one study may have used the time trade-off method, another study may have used the standard gamble in order to elicit those utilities. And that could result in different utilities that are just due to differences in the way that those were elicited. Sometimes people are looking at depression and they have different scales or inventories that they use in order to measure depression. And so those are the things that you want to look at. So that's a little bit different, not just looking at the summary statistic. Obviously, we can easily tell whether one trial is reporting a difference in means and another trial is reporting a relative risk. This is going down even further to the method section of the article and saying, what instrument did you use to derive that summary statistic? And then there's differences in the intervention. And if this is a drug trial, that's pretty easy to evaluate. Sometimes it can get a little tricky. So, for example, we have all these infused medications that have come onto the market, maybe for rheumatoid arthritis or for obviously chemotherapies, all these biologics. And a lot of times these infused medications, the dose is relative to the patient's skin surface area or relative to the patient's BMI. And so if you have, you know, patients that have different BMI or different skin area at baseline, then you could end up with interventions that are different. And so that can be a little bit tricky, especially because if it's something as, you know, relative to the patient's surface area of their skin, that, you know, that's generally not going to be reported in the trial. So the differences in the intervention could also be, you know, if the intervention is a surgery, you may have some surgeons that are better at doing this intervention than others. And so for that reason, oftentimes meta-analyses can be better suited to pharmaceuticals because those are more easily able to be consistent across different studies and settings. A formal assessment of heterogeneity should also be done. So something to think about is that there's always going to be some difference in the effect sizes from different studies. You're never going to find a situation where there's no heterogeneity at all. It's really the extent of heterogeneity that you're evaluating. So we say that studies are homogeneous when the differences in the effect size across the studies is just due to random variation like sampling error. So no differences are due to systematic differences among studies. It's just due to the sampling error. We say that studies are heterogeneous when you have differences in effect sizes that exceeds what you can expect from sampling error alone. And so some of the ways that you can try to figure out whether that's going on is you can see effect sizes that are in different directions across studies, or when you have a magnitude of effect sizes across studies that differs dramatically. There are statistical tests for heterogeneity, but you have to be careful with them. Pretty much all of the statistical tests for heterogeneity have low power. One of them that's oftentimes used is Cochrane's Q, and that's essentially testing the hypothesis that the treatment effects are the same in all of the studies. The problem with this statistic, like many of these tests for heterogeneity, is that it has low power, and this one has low power when you have 10 or fewer studies in your meta-analysis, and that happens a lot when you have 10 or fewer studies. And so in these situations, you could have heterogeneity, but you fail to reject the null hypothesis. And so it looks like, your test is telling you don't have heterogeneity even though you do. So that's obviously a real problem. One of the things you can do in order to make sure that you're not incorrectly rejecting the null hypothesis is to increase your alpha. So you could use a P of less than 0.10 as your significance level as opposed to your normal P of less than 0.05. But then there's also problems in the other direction. If you have studies that have large sample sizes, you could end up rejecting the null hypothesis even when the effect sizes don't differ much. So if you have large sample sizes, your Cochrane's Q may lead you to conclude that, yes, these effect sizes are really different, but in reality, there is no true heterogeneity. So you have problems in both directions. So really, don't put a lot of stock in this Q statistics. I bring it up because people do use it, but I want you to understand that there are problems in using it. It's not just a panacea. You cannot just test the null hypothesis that the true treatment effects are the same using the statistic and sort of wash your hands and say that there's no problem because you fail to reject that. Essentially, because all these diagnostic tests have low power, not just this statistic, you should use your best judgment. If you think you have heterogeneity, then move forward as though you do, and you should handle that in your meta-analysis. Another test is the I-squared statistic, and this tells you the proportion of the total variation across your studies that's due to heterogeneity rather than due to chance. It does use the Q statistic. The benefit of this is not sensitive to the number of studies, so it's not like the Cochrane's Q where you need to have a certain number of studies. There's a rough guide to interpreting this I-squared statistic. Because it uses the Q statistic, it still has its own problems. So, again, you can run these statistical tests. If they show you have heterogeneity and you don't have large sample sizes, you can probably feel pretty good about them. But just because they don't show, just because they may conclude that you don't have heterogeneity doesn't mean that you don't have heterogeneity. So move forward with caution. What I like to do is do a forest plot. I think this is, for me, this is the easiest and best way to assess heterogeneity. And what the forest plot does is it actually plots the summary statistics and the confidence intervals from each one of your individual studies in an unweighted manner onto a graph. Here we have a relative risk. This is a randomized trial of using diuretics in pregnancy. And so here you have the relative risk. 1.0 is, of course, no difference between treatment and comparison. And then you have the confidence intervals, the 95% confidence intervals. And so you can see here that there is heterogeneity in this study, right? Because the confidence intervals of pairs of studies don't overlap. So for example, here and here, the confidence intervals don't overlap. And so what you would want to do now is to try to figure out, okay, is the reason that these confidence intervals don't overlap because of a data entry error, which could commonly be the case, or is it because there's real heterogeneity across these studies? So keep in mind, I'm not evaluating the point estimate when I'm looking at the heterogeneity. I'm evaluating the confidence intervals and the overlap of the confidence intervals when I'm looking at heterogeneity. And if the confidence intervals don't overlap from studies, that's an indicator to me of heterogeneity. Okay. All right. So moving forward, if you've done your forest plot and you find that there are consistent effect sizes and you find that there's not really much heterogeneity across your effect sizes, then that's great. You can focus on your pooled estimate from your meta-analysis. If you do your forest plot and you see that there are variations in these effect sizes, then you could report your pooled estimate in a meta-analysis. You could do a meta-analysis, but you want to make clear to your reader that the true effect could actually be higher or lower than what you're reporting in your meta-analysis because there are these variations in the underlying study. If you see substantial variations in the effect sizes, then your story is really about the variation rather than about doing a meta-analysis and a pooled effect, and you need to do a deeper dive to understand why that variation is occurring and conduct, you know, make sure that when you write up your systematic literature review that you're focusing a lot on reasons for that variation. So in summary, you've got to evaluate heterogeneity. It's the last step before you can decide whether you can do a meta-analysis or not. Do your informal assessment by looking at your data extraction table. You can do a formal assessment by figures or by test of significance. My recommendation is to focus more on the forest plot than anything else. Okay, if you have heterogeneity, what do you do? Well, you can't just exclude studies and then conduct a meta-analysis on your remaining studies. That is heavily, heavily frowned upon. You have to have an excellent reason to exclude studies. Ideally, you should have determined your inclusion and exclusion criteria a priori as to whether the study would be excluded. That would have been step one in your systematic literature search. And so now, if at this point you're trying to exclude a study, you're doing it because you feel like the data don't fit. Well, that's not really a great scientific endeavor. So you've got to have a phenomenal reason for data-driven, scientifically based reason for excluding this study. Some of the things you could do is you could include all of your studies in your base case meta-analysis and then run sensitivity analyses of your meta-analyses where you test excluding these studies. Or you could analyze groups of studies to say, okay, I want to analyze the group of studies that have a 3-month follow-up time separately than the groups of studies that have a 12-month follow-up time. However, if you are going to analyze these groups of studies, you should have determined this a priori before evaluating your heterogeneity. You can use a random effects model. We're going to talk more about this in the next lecture. Or you can conduct a meta-regression. Again, we'll talk more about this in the next lecture. The challenge is that there's not really any clear guidelines for how much heterogeneity sinks the ship such that you can't proceed to meta-analysis. So you essentially have to use your best judgment as an investigator and know that this has to be defensible in a manuscript. All right, so to recap, to do a meta-analysis, most of your time is going to be spent on the initial steps that relate to doing a systematic literature review. When you do a systematic literature review, you have to search the literature, complete a title and abstract review, extract data from your studies, keep the RCTs and the observational studies separate, convert all of the outcomes from each study into the same scale so that you're reporting the same summary statistic, and evaluate the heterogeneity of studies. And you either need to evaluate that there's no heterogeneity or that you're going to handle heterogeneity properly in your meta-analysis before you can proceed to the quantitative pooling. The quantitative pooling is the conducting of the meta-analysis, and we'll talk about that in the next lecture, which is on March 28th. Okay, so in summary, a meta-analysis is a single pooled estimate that you create along with an estimate of variance around that single pooled estimate that is created by weighting and combining individual effects from multiple studies. When you are conducting a meta-analysis, you have to be really careful about making sure your literature review is conducted in a systematic fashion, that you're extracting data consistently from your studies, and that you're properly handling and assessing any heterogeneity. Again, if you have too much heterogeneity, you don't conduct a meta-analysis, you just stop with the literature review. If you are planning on conducting a meta-analysis, I'd recommend that you read these three citations. The first two are textbooks, and the second is the Cochrane Handbook of how to do a systematic literature review, which is, again, the first step of doing a meta-analysis. Great. So, Joe, I'll turn it over to you for any questions, and I know we're near the top of the hour, so you also have my email here if you'd like to email me with any questions.
Yeah, great. We have some questions here, so if we run out, maybe they could follow up with you over email. But one of the questions is, there seems to be a type of meta-analysis using individual-level data. What is this?
Yeah, that's a great question. I didn't want to get into that in the interest of time, but essentially what happens is you have a multitude of studies. And let's say you've done your systematic literature review and you say, okay, there's four randomized controlled trials from the literature. I want to amalgamate them in a systematic fashion and do a meta-analysis. You might be able to get, so what we're doing in a meta-analysis is we're combining the summary statistic from each study. You might be able to, if you're very lucky, to get your hands on the individual patient level from each one of those four studies and then run a meta-analysis using that individual patient level data. That essentially requires writing to each one of those authors of those studies and having them agree to give you their underlying data set. So it is a far and few between kind of exercise, but it is something that's theoretically possible, even though it's not oftentimes realized in practice.
Great. And you noted that observational studies and RCTs, the results should be kept separate. In the JAMA study you noted earlier, they reported separate summaries of each, and then an overall pooled estimate. Should these have been reported separately or in an overall pooled estimate?
Ah, thank you for pointing that out. Yes, they should have been reported separately. I don't remember when that study was published. It may have been published before the guidelines were released by the Cochrane Collaboration and other meta-analysis groups. If you are doing an observational study meta-analysis and RCT meta-analysis, that's where you should end. You should not combine the observational studies with the RCT and report an overall meta-analysis because of the issues of the systematic, the selection bias that occurs within the observational studies but does not occur within the RCT.
Okay, and just a question about observational studies reporting odds ratios versus relative risks. Can you pool them or do you have to transform to the same
thing? Great question. You have to transform them. Observational, well, it depends. If the outcome is rare, that it means that it occurs in less than 10% of the time, you can consider those to be equivalent. If the outcome is not rare, then you cannot consider those to be equivalent, and you're going to need to involve the PhD statistician or write to the authors to get their underlying 2x2 table data. I doubt they'll give you their individual patient-level data. That's also an IRB hassle and data use issues with that and PHI problems, but they will oftentimes give you the 2x2 table from an RCT, and you can then calculate the relative risk or the odds ratio, whichever one you're interested in. If you go back to my last lecture on estimating transition probabilities, there are slides in there that talk about when you can, about using the observational, I'm sorry, about the odds ratio and the relative risk together and when you can do that.
Great. And we had one more, just are there ways to incorporate continuous measures of treatment effectiveness in a decision model and measures of standardized mean differences from meta-analyses?
Yeah, I mean, really, it just depends on what's reported in your studies. So from your systematic literature review, you've got means that are reported and continuous data that are reported. You can pool those into a meta-analysis. It all depends on the structure of the underlying data, which in this case are the summary statistics from the studies included in your systematic literature review.
Great, and that looks like that's it.
Oh, great. All right. Well, thank you all for your time and your attention. For those that are still interested in this topic, which I hope is the majority of you, please stay tuned for my next lecture, which will be about how to actually create that pooled estimate now that you've done the systematic literature review component.
Thank you, everyone, for joining us. I'm going to close the meeting in just a moment here. When I do, you will be prompted with a feedback form. We really do appreciate it if you take a moment or two to fill that out. Thank you, everyone, for joining us, and we look forward to seeing you at a future HR&D Cyber Seminar. Thank you.